I'm grateful to be here. I am going to use the curved pointer. It looked kind of cool there, almost bow-like. So if you fall asleep, right, just... Okay, anyway, this giving a talk towards the end of a conference, you're always grateful if anyone even shows up. And it always reminds me of a little Far Side comic where there's a man with a very small head in a classroom, and he raises his hand and he says, "Mr. Johnson, my brain is full." And usually at the end of a conference, my brain is full, so I'm always impressed when people still have capacity to learn. So anyway, glad to be here. Talk a little bit about some work that we've been doing with weak values and precision measurements. And this has been in a collaboration with Andrew Jordan. He's a theorist at the University of Rochester, and his student Justin Dressel and Nathan Williams. And then my students Ben Dixon, David Starling, Praveen Vujasetu, and Curtis Broadbent. So just to give you a little bit of an outline of how this talk will go, first I'm going to talk about what are weak values. And hopefully this will give you a little bit of background if you haven't already studied these. This thing is a little finicky. And then I'm going to talk about precision deflection measurements, and then precision phase measurements, and then some recent work that we've been doing on precision frequency and magnetic field measurements. Okay, so weak values. A few years ago, I heard about weak values, and I must admit that the first time I heard them, I thought it sounded like a stretch of that people couldn't find a new interesting topic, so they generated something new. And but shortly after I saw a paper by Ulner Hosten and Paul Kwiat, I changed my mind about them and started working on them and became quite interested in their applications. And just to give you a little background, this is actually started in 1988 by Aronoff, Albert, and Weidman, and had some interesting ideas, and then several other things started to show up in terms of deflections, polarization, so on and so forth. And then there's been a couple of recent beautiful papers by Charlie Bamber and also by Ephraim Steinberg's groups on looking at how weak values can address fundamental questions in quantum mechanics. But the thing that really got me interested was this work by Ulner Hosten and Paul Kwiat, in which they were able to show that they could measure very, very small displacements. And this was a polarization dependent displacement that you get at a dielectric interface. And they were able to see displacements of the order of an angstrom. And I wanted to look at effects that were not polarization dependent. I wanted to be able to look at a displacement or a deflection that did not require a particular polarization, because polarization-dependent deflections are hard to come by, but there are a lot of deflections where one requires very precise alignment. So I started thinking about this, and we came up with some of these techniques that I'll talk about a little bit later. Just to give you a little bit of an idea about weak values, I wanted to couch this in terms of the Stern-Gerlach experiment. So Stern and Gerlach, what they were interested in doing was testing the quantized orbital angular momentum of silver. They actually believed that it had an orbital angular momentum of 1. So they were expecting to see 3 lines. They worked really hard to get large enough fringing magnetic fields, so on and so forth, so that they could see 3 lines. But what they actually measured was 2. And it wasn't until a few years later that there was actually a realization that there is a spin degree of freedom here that's intrinsic. And with that, we were able to unlock the spectroscopic structure of the atom. So here's the basic idea. Why do we call spin up? Well, it's because spin up corresponds to a deflection that is upward. So I'm just going to denote this little arrow by saying this atom has a spin that is up. After it passes through this fringing magnetic field, really what we're saying is that the spin couples to the magnetic field, which then gives it a transverse momentum,
which then causes it to be deflected upward. And so we say that for that particular spin up with this fringing magnetic field, we get an eigenvalue of plus h bar over 2. And if we have a spin down, it couples to the magnetic field. There's a transverse momentum kick, and we measure down at the minus h bar over 2 eigenvalue. Now things start to become interesting when we introduce things like an SX plus state, which is an equal value decomposition of spin up and spin down with a fixed relative phase. And as it goes into this fringing magnetic field, you get a decomposition into two amplitudes. One goes to the plus h bar over 2 and one to the minus h bar over 2. And upon being measured, it projects into one of those eigenstates. Now, weak values is actually kind of a regression, as it were. Instead of having a strong fringing magnetic field, what you do is you turn it way down until the eigenvalues are separated by a value that's much smaller than, for example, even the transverse diameter or a wave function of this, of these atoms, so that there is no resolution between the amplitudes, or the splitting between the amplitudes is so small that you can't essentially detect it using these just where it falls onto the screen. So what we're going to do now is do something a little different. Instead of taking it directly to the screen, I want to recall a little bit something here. Basically, you remember that we had an SX plus state. This SX plus state went into this fringing magnetic field, and this gave it essentially a Z unitary, a sigma Z operation, as it were. And then, akin to what Sakurai discusses in Chapter 1, we're going to put this atom through a filter. And this filter is oriented such that it is a projection. It projects out those states which have not an SX minus state, but something very close to the SX minus state. Can't be exactly the SX minus state because there would be no atoms that made it through, but it's going to be very close to this SX minus state. So you recall we put in something that's SX plus. Now we're putting it through a filter that's nearly SX minus. And the effect there is that after it passes through this, it now takes on the polarization of that medium, polarization of the filter, and then comes out such that its mean value can be displaced at a distance greater outside of the normal eigenvalue bounds. Now this is, I think there's been a little bit of a misunderstanding in terms of what weak values actually means. It's not that we're really measuring spins with 100, for example. What it means is we're measuring a deflection that would correspond to a spin of 100. Okay, it's our atoms are still spin 1/2 atoms, but here's the basic idea. What we did is we had some initial input state, which we called psi in. Then we applied some operation here, which we said was a, in our particular case, it was this fringing magnetic field in the z direction. And then we have some psi out state. And that psi out and psi in are nearly orthogonal, not quite, but they're very close to being orthogonal. Now, since this was performed in the z direction operation, but this is not an eigenstate of z, performing this on here made it so that this is actually a relatively large number, whereas this term right here is almost zero, since they're almost orthogonal. And so what that does is it gives us a mean value that is outside of the standard distribution. And what I've represented here is this is the what you would refer to as a single atom transverse probability distribution. The eigenvalues of those spin up and spin down are within that transverse distribution, but the measured mean is a distance away or outside of these eigenvalue bounds. Okay? So, now, any two-dimensional quantum system is isomorphic to a spin 1/2 atom, for example. So, instead of dealing with atoms that are up or down or whatever, or spin up or spin down, or some two-level atom. We can discuss this in terms of a photon, where the photon has, for example, the which way uncertainty in an interferometer. So I don't know if you've done Google SketchUp, but Google SketchUp was fun, so I decided to learn this on a vacation in Hawaii. This is my attempt at recreating the lab in a an optical way, making an animation. So, as those of you who are experimentalists will probably notice, this is a vortex laser. What we have is an interferometer. This is a Sagnac interferometer. Sagnac interferometers are very nice because they're very stable. And if the Sagnac interferometer is built just right so that you get perfect alignment and it's completely ideal, then all of the light will enter and exit out the same port of the interferometer. The beautiful thing about a Sagnac interferometer is, for example, if you have some sort of turbulence right here, or you have some phase disruption, whatever, then the path length going counterclockwise and clockwise is the same because they have to pass, it is the same optical path length for both directions. So you can get quite good phase stability. Even in a relatively modest thing, you can get an order of one part per million phase stability. And if you're really careful, much better than that. So what we're going to do is we're going to basically take a photon exiting this beam splitter with an amplitude that's going one way versus an amplitude going another way. And this is akin to the spin up and spin down of this atom. And what we're going to do is we're going to take this photon and then we're going to put it arrive at this mirror, which is at the halfway point in this interferometer. And then on this mirror, we have a little piezoelectric device which causes a tilt on this so that we get a tilt that is dependent on the direction of propagation inside the medium. And then what we need to be able to do is create a state similar to that filter. Now what we're going to do is instead of akin to that filter that we had that was nearly SX minus, what we can have an analogous thing is the dark port of the interferometer. The dark port of the interferometer is basically, if we're able to tune it right, that essentially represents those atoms that make it through that filter. But how do we control the amount of atoms that make it through, or number of photons that make it through that filter? We have a little device here that is basically, it's just a half-wave plate and a Soleil-Babinet compensator. And a Soleil-Babinet compensator, all it does is it changes the relative phase for a horizontally polarized photon versus a vertically polarized photon. So we put in light that was horizontally polarized into the interferometer, and then it comes through this wave plate, which is rotated at 45 degrees relative to that axis so that it flips the polarization. So that means a horizontally polarized photon will come here and be flipped to vertical, come through here, so it's vertical coming this direction and horizontal coming this direction, so that they pick up a relative phase in the Soleil-Babinet compensator, which is just two birefringent wedges, and then the horizontally polarized photon then gets flipped to being vertically polarized, so that we can control this by simply adjusting the relative position of these two wedges, how much phase, relative phase, there is in this interferometer. Then these amplitudes recombine at this beam splitter and then are measured at a quad detector. So what we wanted to do is we wanted to compare the results here. We wanted to say, how good are the deflections arriving at this quad detector with and without this beam splitter in? So light is going to come here, for example, hit off this mirror, go to this mirror that has this deflection, and then come back and be measured on this quad detector. And we want to compare that with and without the beam splitter in to get a good estimate. So the numbers that I'm going to show in a little bit are those numbers. Okay. So the last thing just I want to make mention of is this quad detector. And a quad detector is a very simple device. It's basically four photodiodes that are very close together. There's about a 100 micron gap here. And what this does is, for example, if you want to measure a horizontal displacement or deflection, what you want to do is you want to look at the total intensity falling on these two and subtract from the total intensity falling on these two detectors. And if you want to look at it up down, then you look at the total intensity falling on these two and subtract it from the total intensity falling on these two detectors. Okay. So here's the analogous things here. In the Stern-Gerlach experiment versus the interferometer, spin is just the which path. Fringing field is the mirror deflection. The transverse probability distribution is the transverse spatial mode distribution. So we have whatever that beam is falling on the detector. And what we're looking at here is the deflection of atom here. We're looking at the deflection of that beam on the quad detector. Okay, so here are the results. We have three curves here. Actually, I just found out that there are some papers that people have been really concerned why this data didn't exactly fit here. And I thought that was really kind of funny. Someone posted something on the archive that they were concerned why that didn't fit very well. I thought it fit great. So anyway, 7.2 degrees, we thought it worked pretty well. But basically, this is what you have to remember here. This is 7.2 degrees. That's the relative phase acquired between the counterclockwise and clockwise path. And so when you're dealing with 7.2 degrees, you have very little light falling on your detector. You have any sorts of problems with the interferometer. We never get perfect contrast on these interferometers. You can get an extinction ratio of about 1,000 to 1 in a really good situation. So when you're running in a really low light regime, it's very difficult to get it to exactly match up to theory. But this is, as you start putting a little more light on it, things started matching much better, and so on and so forth. So what this is if we have a beam in there and we slowly caused a little bit more divergence so that by the time the beam arrived at the detector, this is the beam waste, and this is the beam deflection in microns, and this is the amplification factor. So, for example, with and without the beam splitter in, this particular thing would correspond to about 130 times more deflection with the beam splitter versus with it out. And currently our best deflection is several, amplification factor is several thousand in the neighborhood, somewhere between 5,000 and 10,000 in the neighborhood. So. Now, if we want to look at the actual amount of deflection, what we did is, this is the piezo driving voltage. So we put on those small fluctuations onto that mirror, and then we said for a particular driving voltage, this is what we would expect as the total deflection. This is what we measured on the quad detector. This is the spec that we got based on both what the manufacturer specs the piezo device as, and also what we measured with the camera. So we had a camera on there where we could see very accurate displacements at these large voltage systems. But as we started to get very, very low, obviously you can't use a camera anymore because now you're dealing with very, very small displacements here. And at this point, for example, this corresponds to about, this is a theoretical prediction of 560 femtoradians, and we measured about 400 femtoradians. So to give you an idea of what that corresponds to, if you take a beam of light from the Seattle Space Needle to the Empire State Building and you had a non-curved Earth so that one could actually do this, that would be a great engineering feat, I might add. Then this would correspond to about 2 microns of deflection. Or as Ephraim eloquently put it in a review of this, that it's a hair's breadth at the distance of the moon. I can't quite say as eloquently as Ephraim said it, but anyway, so if you're at the moon, it would correspond to about the diameter of your hair in terms of how much displacement or deflection that would be. Okay, so now we've just used classical beams. a thing that you have to remember here is, I think sometimes we get a little bit caught up in the fact that, well, you haven't really done anything quantum mechanical, and I agree with that. I think there's some interesting things that we can learn from a quantum perspective that is very valuable. And I think this is a classic example where we've learned something interesting thinking about things quantum mechanically. But you can use classical Maxwell's equations to get the same results. However, I didn't find those. So Maxwell's equations predicts the same results. You'd be amazed if it did not, right, if you're using a classical beam. But not very intuitive. I actually prefer a different approach, which is, after talking to Hans Bachor and Claude Fabre about this, I think this is a very good way of thinking about this. So basically, if you have a TEM00 beam, which is just described by this exponential transverse probability distribution or transverse amplitude distribution, and you tilt it, okay, what you can say is that you can actually model this as an electric field with some sort of displacement, where this is actually a complex number. The real part corresponds to the displacement, and the imaginary part corresponds to the tilt. And if you do this all out, if you, you know, consider diffraction and through propagation, so on and so forth, you see some things happen here. This term is just the TM00 beam, but then you get what looks like, for very small tilts, you get a term that looks like a TM01 beam, and you get two terms. One is your tilt. This corresponds to your tilt term, and this corresponds to a displacement term, right? If you move, go a distance L with an angle of theta, then you get an L theta displacement. Fairly obvious, and that's what you see on a detector, but you don't actually, in real space, see a tilt, and that corresponds to this imaginary component. However, if you take the Fourier transform of a tilt, right, Fourier transform of a tilt corresponds to a displacement. And so if you put a lens here, then you'll actually pick this up, but it's shift invariant here, and so you won't pick this up. So the Fourier transform allows you to look at all of these various components. The sort of remarkable thing about this, and I thought this was the most intuitive thing for me, is that if you now put in two beams, because essentially what we did is we have two beams entering into a beam splitter, you're trying to make them roughly indistinguishable here. What you find out is that when you do all of the calculations through, you get something that looks like destructive interference on the TM00 components and constructive interference for the TM01 components, which has the effect of making it look like a greatly enhanced signal. Now, it's not exactly completely destructive or completely constructive. It actually goes as the sine for these two terms, sine of phi, but for small angles, that term is small, and it goes as the cosine for the other terms. And one other thing that's really quite cool, well, cool from a physicist perspective, not necessarily from a surfer's perspective, but this actually did something that looked like the Fourier transform, because it turned this term that was a tilt into the real component, just like you did when you had the Fourier transform, and it made this into the imaginary component. So you're not actually looking at the displacement of the beam at the output of this interferometer, you're looking at the tilt of the beam. So what happens is, it doesn't matter how big your interferometer is, you'll get the same results independent of the size of the interferometer. I thought that was, and you could see this when we were doing the weak value calculations, but it just popped out that way, and it was really surprising to me, but after doing this, it makes sense. Okay, so other people have taken this and run with this. This is an interesting paper by Mark Kasevich's group, where they did the same result, but now what they did is they put into what's an angle amplifier, and this angle amplifier basically is two mirrors that are essentially roughly parallel, and then you bounce it over multiple times, and then they were able to get one picoradian roughly per root hertz sensitivity, and another one is what they call IQAC. This was at the University of Washington, where they're looking at these very sensitive or very small changes in gravity over small distances. And this is essentially a quasi-autocollimator, and they were able to improve things. They were able to get about 10 picoradians per root hertz. Now, just to give you an idea, the best autocollimators out there before this were at least two orders of magnitude less than this. Not necessarily because they're fundamentally limited by that, but there's always limitations due to noise effects. And in many ways, this is able to get rid of a lot of noise terms. So, and we've been able to measure on our system, we're very close to the shot noise limit. We get about 1 picoradian per root hertz in our experiments without the amplifications. So, which means in 1 second of integration, you get 1 picoradian of sensitivity. Okay, how much time do I have? I'm probably running. Okay. Signal noise ratio. That's where the real answers lie. Doesn't really matter if you have a million-fold enhancement of something if you don't get any photons, right? So if you're taking a hit in your signal but you're getting a huge deflection, right? If you have a million photons to start off with, and now you only get 3 through, but those 3 have a very large relative displacement to what they used to, what really is going to matter here? So you're getting a lot of enhancement of your signal, but you have a very small signal since you have a dramatic reduction in your number of photons. And so we really want to do a careful analysis of what is going to win out in these systems. And I'll be very quick here, but here's the basic idea. If I just have a square laser beam and it's falling on 2 detectors and I move this a distance d, right, then the number of photons falling on one side is just going to be half minus dn over l, and similar for here. So if you subtract the two, you get 2 dn over l. If you just look at the variance of these things, it turns out to be exactly equal to the number of photons. So the signal-to-noise ratio is 2 dn over l, root n over l. So this is what you would refer to as this shot noise limit for this system. However, with these weak values, what we find is an enhancement that goes as this, however, at the expense of loss of signal. So this is for a small angle, we get this, so we get a reduction in the probability that we get photons through, and d, and where this l is the distance from the mirror to the detector. When we do all this out, what we find out is that the signal and noise ratio for weak values is 2k a squared over l. So you want to optimize this to get yourself the best signal-to-noise ratio. So, in fact, we've been able to make this about 50 times larger. And I want to point out, this is all geometric terms. It doesn't have anything to do with root n here, because it turns out that this and this cancel. So you're really doing an apples-to-apples comparison of signal-to-noise ratio. You're taking the number of photons in the interferometer, even if you don't measure all of the photons from the interferometer. Okay, so the important point here is this is the signal-to-noise ratio with amplification. This is without amplification. So this is the measured, this is the shot noise limited without amplification. But the key term is this graph right here. If you want to get a really good signal-to-noise ratio with a beam, what you want to do is you want to get it to be as small as you can possibly get it. Right? And that's what's represented by this curve. This is what people normally want to use. So what they want to do is they focus the beam down until the beam waste is very, very small. You can get a very large signal and noise ratio. The problem is it kills you for many reasons. One is turbulence. Another one is there's gaps in these detectors. There's a whole host of technical reasons why it's very hard to get to the shot noise limit using these techniques. And what I mean shot noise limit, I actually mean there's geometric components as well, which is simply the size of the beam waste. Whereas with weak values, it's linear in the system. You actually want a bigger beam, and there's a maximum amount you can get. So here we showed that we could get about picoradian per root hertz. So I want to end actually on this. Basically, instead of having a mirror, what you do is you put in a prism, and then what happens is you get a spectrally dependent deflection, and you can do precision measurements of frequency. Now, this becomes interesting if you actually do something more interesting. Okay. Instead of using a prism, which has incredibly low dispersion, what we did is we used what we're phrasing as an atomic prism, and we get 5 orders of magnitude more sensitivity by using the large dispersion between 2 hyperfine ground state resonances, and we're able to get down to about the hertz per root hertz spectral sensitivity. And so we can start having absolute frequency references and also frequency measurements. We believe we can get down to the subhertz regime. Okay, and this is the basic idea that we're able to measure many, using this prism, we're able to measure many different spectral spots, and this answers some of the basic questions that have annoyed people like me for a long time, which is, how do you separate all the frequencies in four-wave mixing in a hot gas? Atomic prism is your answer. And this is, so it was discussed earlier today by Alex Dubovsky. We can actually measure multiple spectral lines. We can measure many teeth of an optical frequency comb, and just using these prisms and using this as a technique for actually using weak size as a technique for getting down to the shot noise limited value of precision frequency measurements. Okay, so I'll just end there. So anyway, other things that working on, tests of quantum mechanics and non-locality, a weak value wave meter, precision magnetic fields. This is the thing that we're putting most of our energy into right now. We think we can get down to very, very, very sensitive magnetic field measurements using these techniques. And then general relativity. So, thank you.